20 Babies, an unexpectedly quick introduction to vaginal birth. I delivered 20 babies in the summer of 1977. I was hardly more than a baby myself, just turned 24 and starting my third year of medical school. At that point, I was toying with the idea of becoming a family practitioner or general surgeon. Babies didn't figure much into my future. This is how my obstetrics rotation was supposed to work. A medical student was typically paired with an intern, who in turn was under the direct supervision of a senior resident. The senior resident did the complicated cases, forceps deliveries, cesarean sections, and such, while the intern handled the routine vaginal births. And so, one sweltering Chicago morning, I stood in my crinkly white coat before Mitch, a stocky, gruff senior resident with a startled head of jet black hair and a permanent dusting of cigarette ash down the front of his scrubs. "Okay, you had some OB training in your physical assessment class, right?" Mitch asked. "No," I told him, "I hadn't." My physical assessment class had been at the Veterans Hospital down the street. There I had watched men with terminal lung cancer chain smoke cigarettes through their tracheostomy tubes, had seen others who had lost limbs to diabetes or D-Day landmines, and had personally examined what a senior resident described as the case of the year, a cab driver who got scurvy, from a decades-long diet of plain White Castle hamburgers and Coke, period. Not only had I not seen a baby born at the VA, I told Mitch, I hadn't seen a single female patient. The woman climbing onto the bed in front of us would be the first woman I'd ever touched with medical intent. Mitch scratched the stubble on his cheek. "Well, you've read about childbirth, haven't you?" I said that I had. Just the night before, in fact. Half a chapter, with diagrams. Took me 20 minutes. "No problem, then." He slapped me on the back. "Just sit there." He motioned me to a rolling stool between the woman's now propped up legs. "And call me when you see a head." Then he left. I sat there for 2 hours. I killed time by rearranging the contents of my pockets, cleaning my stethoscope, and once I had overcome my shyness, talking to the woman who was to produce the head I had been ordered to be on the lookout for. Her name was Tanya. She was 2 months younger than I was. This was her third child. Her oldest, a girl, was just 2 and a half. And she absolutely hated childbirth. She compared the pain of having a baby to the pain of being stabbed, which she had been, twice, both times being cases of mistaken identity, she assured me. But childbirth was the worst, she said, because it's like they won't take the knife out. Childbirth and knifing, two experiences I had never had. I took Tanya's word for it. A sudden eruption of curses drew my attention. Startled, I looked down between Tanya's legs and saw the top of a tiny head pushing out from her vagina. Now it was just me, the swearing Tanya, and the top third of a birthing baby's head. Tanya's curses were getting personal now. She had finished damning her absent husband for putting her through this agony not once, not twice, but 3 times, and now she turned her attention to me. "Get that damn baby out of me!" she shrieked, glaring at me over the top of her belly. "Get it out or I'll cut you!" I was losing the battle. There was now an entire head under my hand, face and all. Amniotic fluid bubbled from its nose. Its mouth opened and closed in some horrible parody of breathing. Caught between threats of mayhem and my feeble attempts to hold back eons of childbirthing evolution, I closed my eyes and surrendered myself to whatever came next.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host, and you've been listening to Dr. Mark Sloan's brand new book, Birthday, A Pediatrician Explores the Science, History, and Wonder of Childbirth. It's published by Ballantine Books, an imprint of Random House. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Rosemary. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's a dynamite opening. I can't recall when I've read anything quite like that.
Well, it was kind of a dynamite introduction to childbirth, too. So.
Let me introduce you to our listeners. Mark describes himself as pediatrician, husband, and father. He has attended more than 3,000 births. Mm-hmm. He's a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics for 25 years. He practices at Kaiser in Santa Rosa. And among the pediatricians in the Kaiser Permanente Northern California region, he is among the most highly rated physicians. His writing has appeared in the Chicago Tribune and the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's starting out tomorrow on a nationwide tour for his book. So we're lucky to have you.
Okay, thank you.
I think you must be very good at time management.
I'm very good at getting things done at the last second, let's put it that way.
Maybe that's the same thing. One of the first questions I want to ask you, and I find that most writers like to be asked this, where did you learn to write like that?
Well, I owe most of my writing talent, I think, to my mother. She was a columnist and editor in our local newspaper back in Illinois, and she won quite a few awards. She won a National Press Women's Association Award in the 80s for her work, and in Illinois, the state AP and UPI awards for her columns. So she's quite a talented writer. Mm-hmm. And when I go back another generation, my grandfather, my mom's father, was a master Irish storyteller. He was not a writer because I don't think that was a skill that was valued for him at that time. But he could tell stories, and he did tell stories.
Yes.
till we all finally went to bed. So.
And you can tell a good story, too. You have a real flair for narrative. When I was reading the acknowledgments or something, I just have to ask you about, you said, and yes, there was Sarah Jane Freeman who missed her subway stop. Now, that sounds like a good story.
Yeah, Sarah Jane is my agent, and at the time I was sending out, at each step of writing this book, I took the approach that, well, at least I will have tried if I don't get an agent or I don't get a book contract. And I had mailed out the queries to agents, and her office had requested the whole first chapter. So I sent it to her, and I got this voicemail a few days later that she had been writing from the Brooklyn Academy of Music back to her apartment in just off Central Park, and she had just about missed her subway stop because she was so engrossed in reading it. And at one point, someone wanted to see what she was reading because she kept laughing out loud. So, So Sarah Jane's been a great agent, though.
And then you also credit Adair Lara, whom mm-hmm. you describe as a friend and a writing mentor.
Yes, I would trace my serious writing beginning back to a class I took in her home, a 10-week seminar in her home in San Francisco on personal essay writing. And it was out of that class I had really my first article published, not locally. This was in the Chicago Tribune. And I got a lot of confidence from her. And since then, she's been a great a friend and mentor. And I've had another couple of classes with her.
So. Yeah, I'd like to read her blurb that's on the back of your book. Adair Lara says, I have given birth twice, but until this book, I never grasped the true wonder of what happens to mother and child during childbirth. Birthday is an amazing, tender, funny book about our big-headed species. And then let's talk about Susan Bono mm-hmm. of Petaluma, mm-hmm. who you give a great deal of credit for helping you polish your mm-hmm. writing.
Yeah, Susan, well, about 3 years ago, I initially thought I was going to write columns, child health columns. And over time, it sort of slowly evolved that what I really wanted to do was write a book. And then beyond that, I started realizing that what I found most interesting was birth and the first day or so of life. But like most writers, I finally hit a wall, and I wasn't getting much further with it. And a friend of mine had recommended that I contact Susan, both as an editor and as that she has several writing groups, to see if I could get into one. And Susan, I really do give her credit for moving me along in the process because I remember one chapter, I don't remember which chapter it was, but one in particular, I was just absolutely stuck and she read it and she took a day or two and then she just finally said, why don't you move this paragraph to here? And that was all it took to break it up is that I just had it out of sequence, but I had it locked in my head that that's the way it should read. And she edited several of the chapters when I was, getting them ready to send off to New York. And, so that was a big help to me, and also the writing group. And I would recommend anybody who wants to be a writer to get in a writing group of supportive people because I'm tomorrow morning again going to Petaluma to our writing group down mm-hmm. there. And they're really a great bunch of people, and everybody, mm-hmm. we're all rooting for each other and not afraid to tell each other when we've wandered off mm-hmm. the path writing-wise.
Well, Margit Leash, mm-hmm. who's in your writing group, was my most recent interview.
Oh, really? For, that's right. She told me she was
Novel Idea on her novel Hollywood Buzz.
Yeah.
And then Chuck Kensler, who's in mm-hmm. your group, is going to do a program with me on a book called Choteau Creek. So mm-hmm. I'm really raiding Susan's group.
Well, Chuck's book, when that comes out, he's doing some fabulous writing. And when he gets that together into a book, it's going to be great. And Margit has been my role model for, I even asked her, what kind of pens do you use to sign people's books and things like that? Because she's done this before. So.
Yeah, well, I've worked with Susan as well, mm-hmm. and she's famous for mm-hmm. that ability mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. reach into your writing and say, why don't you just tweak this and move that. And mm-hmm. also she has such a gentle manner.
She does. She rarely hit me with sticks.
That's right. And then did we mention her literary journal, Tiny Lights?
Oh, no. Yeah, I did it my opening. Yeah. Yeah. Tiny Lights is a wonderful small press literary journal. Mm-hmm. One of her many hats she wears, but she's mm-hmm. the editor and publisher of Tiny Lights.
Yeah. You're very generous with your acknowledgments in the book. That was interesting to read. And when the other night when you made your debut at Copperfields in Santa Rosa, that was a wonderful evening.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. What a terrific crowd.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd seen that big a crowd since Alexander McCall Smith was there.
Yeah, at the end of it, the Copperfields, Stephanie Dagnan, the events coordinator,
she's
figured
very
it was
good.
Like 300 to 350 people or something. So it was. Is I'm still right? hearing from people who were there that I never saw because I was down signing books.
So, you didn't have a chance to look up that night.
I'm glad they were all having fun. I was busy.
Well, it must have been very gratifying.
Fun.
And incidentally, listeners, you can buy the book at Copperfields as well as other bookstores. And I should probably give the name of the book again. It's written by Mark Sloan, and it's called Birthday, A Pediatrician Explores the Science, the History, and the Wonder of Childbirth. I want to talk a bit about the physical book itself, because it's very beautiful. It's a nice size. Mm-hmm. It's easy to hold. And very, very attractive. I don't know how much input you had on the appearance of the book, but I think you certainly must be pleased with the way it looks.
Yeah, I'm very pleased. It's Ballantine Books, but they're an imprint of Random House, so the people I'm working with are all at Random House. Mm-hmm. But they asked my input all the way through. I had very little to suggest in the way of changes because I was very happy. That the cover that's on it now is really the first one they sent me. Mm-hmm. My editor, Susanna Porter, she's now the executive editor at Random House, and they made the decision to keep it in the smaller format, not to make it a big book, because for exactly what you're saying, it would be much more comfortable for people to hold.
Right.
And just physically, it's just a very nice book. I'm really pleased with it.
And the baby feet on the cover.
Yes, everybody wants to know whose baby feet those are. I have no idea. It's a stock photograph.
Well, I also like the background of that lovely linen with the hem stitching and the embroidery on it. I mean, kind of an old-fashioned look. I remember when baby things used to look like that. Mm-hmm. Of course, they were usually just for show. We didn't actually put them on the babies because they wouldn't last long. But it's a beautiful book. And as we get into it, I wonder if you would read the dedication in the book.
For Elizabeth, Claire, and John, without whose love I would have no story to tell. For my mother, Peg, who birthed 7 big-headed Sloan babies, and my father, Barney, who got Mom to the hospital on time, every time. And for James Bernard Sloan, the brother I never knew.
That's a really, really, don't close the book. We're going to the next page, to the poetry.
Oh, okay.
But that is really a beautiful dedication. And I love the juxtaposition of the poets that you chose for the next page. I don't think I've ever seen William Blake and Gracie Allen on the same page again. So if you'll read William Blake, I'll read Gracie Allen.
Okay. This is from William Blake. My mother groaned, my father wept. Into the dangerous world I leapt, helpless, naked, piping loud, like a fiend hid in a cloud.
And here's Gracie Allen. When I was born, I was so surprised I couldn't talk for a year and a half. that's a wonderful way to get into the book. So let's go to right into the content of the book. Why do gorillas have it so easy?
Simple visual. It boils down to a 300-pound mother and a 3-pound baby. gorilla fetus, I mean, it's just a very straightforward birth. In fact, that's one of the reasons I got interested in writing the book initially was years ago I was reading, I believe it was a National Geographic, just about some gorilla research they were doing. And just in a throwaway paragraph, the author mentioned how one of the females had left the group that evening off to the side of a clearing and come back in about 20, 30 minutes with the baby. And I remember thinking, wow, that sounded easy. And that got me wanting to read more about it because here I'd already been to several hundred births. And the comparison was a little jarring between how difficult it is for humans to have birth and how easy it was for a gorilla to have birth. It comes down to that's the way primates evolved, and we're the only primate species that has this much trouble giving birth to our babies. The gorilla fetus never touches the pelvic bones. It just comes straight through, and, you know, the vagina. It's all soft tissue. There's very little, that has to go on. So it's a very, very easy birth.
And then the gorilla baby has the ability to take care of itself pretty much.
Yeah, somewhat.
From day
and
one.
It varies from species to species. In primates, it varies quite a bit. You know, the gorilla baby can cling and, you know, feed itself. Some monkey species, actually, the babies help with their own deliveries. They actually start pushing their way out once they get their arms free. It's rather eerie sounding.
One would think, given eons of evolutionary tinkering, that Homo sapiens could come up with an easier way to birth its babies. What's the point of putting the mother and child through such a painful, risky ordeal? Why aren't we more like other species, most of whom get the business of reproduction over with quickly and easily? Why can't we just spawn like salmon, lay eggs like chickens, or bud like yeast? More to the point, why can't we give birth the way gorillas do? The female gorilla is a study in childbirthing efficiency. When labor begins, she simply ambles off to the edge of her group and has her baby in a half hour or so, with few visible signs of discomfort. She does this without help. The other members of her group usually ignore her. Compared to a human childbirth, which lasts an average of 18 painful hours the first time around, and almost always requires assistance from those nearby, gorillas have it easy. If Tanya had been born a gorilla, I think she would have preferred childbirth to getting stabbed. Gorilla birth is made relatively easy by a fact of obstetrical anatomy. Mom is big, fetus is small. Because the female pelvis is so roomy compared to the fetus that must pass through it, birth is a straightforward process. The gorilla fetus starts and finishes labor in the same position, head down, facing forward, towards its mother's abdominal wall. No twists or turns, no shifting orientation as it negotiates its exit. Just down, down, and out. Human childbirth, though, is more like an Olympic bobsled run. There are two participants with well-defined roles, a mother who does the pushing and a fetus who steers the course. There's a well-marked start and finish, and in between, there are bank turns and the real possibility of disaster. Down at the finish line, there are a throng of cheering supporters, some of them ready to assist when things get tricky, others simply milling around with cameras and champagne.
Yeah, that chapter was just full of fascinating stories, like the ones about the different varieties of primates. But did this all happen because at some point human beings stood up and mm-hmm. started walking mm-hmm. on their hind legs?
There's two major remodelings of the human pelvis during evolution. The first one was actually, most people think it was because of head size, but it was actually in response to upright walking. When our ancestors came down from the trees and moved out into the savannas, there was a big advantage to being able to stand up and look over the grass or look over a mound to see both food and danger. And in standing up, for a lot of mechanical reasons, that caused the shoulders to broaden. And then the additional use of hands for tools and things caused the shoulders to broaden even further. So early on, the human pelvis, or the pre-human pelvis, started to get wider to allow the shoulders to get out. And that was the first adaptation. And the second one was to big heads, because once we had those freed up hands, we could think of all good uses for them or bad uses for them. And there was a lot of pressure put on bigger brains, more abilities to use your hands and problem solve and things. And that made the pelvis deeper from front to back. So where a gorilla pelvis in the birth canal is really kind of like a cylinder, just a straight cylinder. Over time, the human pelvis has become wider and deeper to the point that it's kind of like a cylinder with the top half squished perpendicularly. It's a hard visual there. But if you think of a toilet paper roll and with the top half flattened a bit from side to side, that's how the human pelvis is. So it's pretty tricky for a baby to get down there, which is why why it takes so long and it's so difficult.
Yes. One of the things that impresses me particularly about you is that you're willing to tell stories about yourself in which you don't appear in a particularly flattering light, as in the first reading that we had about the first delivery in which you were present, and I think that's rather rare.
Well, I have a family that won't let me get away with dressing myself up too much. So.
Well, it's so appealing. I mean, sometimes people tend to put a doctor on a pedestal, but when the doctor tells a story like that about himself, then you feel very much at ease with that doctor. And so I thought that was a very nice way to reveal your the way that you approach probably the way you approach life is it not only delivering babies but in every aspect. I really enjoyed everything in the book, but I can't. We can't talk about everything, but the first 5 minutes of life, what an amazing chapter that was. You know, it's a wonder anybody survives that first 5 minutes.
Well, it is. I mean, it's such an incredible transition you have to make from being in an all liquid environment to out and breathing and going from a fetus to a baby. You actually change how the blood flows through your body and how the blood flows through your heart. There's all kinds of adaptations that have to take place, and it's amazing that it fails so rarely. So,
and the baby really goes from one world to another. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, physically, but all the transformation that takes place in that.
Yeah, you figure you start. I mean, a fetus gets its oxygen indirectly from its mother's breathing. Right. And the oxygen travels through the bloodstream to the placenta, jumps over to the fetus's circulation in the placenta, then down the umbilical cord, and through a series of really ingenious little bypasses, it bypasses the lungs within the fetus's body, and then comes back out again. And then, as soon as the cord's cut, everything has to change, and all those temporary bypasses close, and a baby has to suddenly breathe, which they haven't been doing much of, just some little play breathing in utero. And it's something that we take for granted. It's one of those hiding in plain sight things I like about childbirth is we see it so much, we figure, oh yeah, well, that's what they do. But all the stuff is going on inside the baby. It's just, it's really remarkable. To me, it's the most amazing moment in life. I think it's the most dramatic one. It's more dramatic than death, because in death things are shutting down. Well, in birth they're just switching over. You know, transitioning from an all liquid world to an all air breathing world. So.
I was racking my brain to think if I'd ever had any 5 minutes that were as transforming as that, and I thought of an experience I had maybe 6 years ago or so when I was rafting on the Colorado River, and it was we're going through enormous rapids. The sound was just overwhelming. I was hanging on for dear life, and all of a sudden the raft flipped and I was under the boat, and it was silent. And I thought maybe that just sudden change from, and then of course it was also freezing cold, from one moment you're roaring through a rapids and the next minute you're underwater. And I thought that the shock of an experience like that might be something like a baby experiences in the first 5 minutes.
Well, and in the book I use the analogy of, most people think of a baby being born as a baby being startled or surprised, but it goes way beyond that, because it's, this baby has moved from these confines, these very comfortable, warm, liquid confines, to a world that has some knowledge from noise and things in utero, but no idea. I mean, much more light, different sounds, smells. I mean, there's smells the baby's never encountered, and touches, and the fact that its arms and legs are no longer confined. They're flinging out in space, that it's, we've all gone through it, but I don't think anybody really can comprehend. What a massive change that can be.
And of course, we don't remember it.
No.
It happened to
everyone.
Some
people claim they remember it, but I don't.
We're going to take a short break. This is Rosemary Manchester. You're listening to A Novel Idea. My guest is Dr. Mark Sloan, who's just published a book called Birthday, A Pediatrician Explores the Science, the History, and the Wonder of Childbirth. And we'll be right back.
You're having my baby.
My baby.
What a lovely way of saying what you're thinking of me. I can see it. Your face is glowing. I can see it in your eyes. I'm happy knowing that you're having my baby.
My baby.
You're the woman I love, and I love what I'm doing to you. You're having my baby. You're a woman in love, and you love what's going through you. The need inside you, I see it showing. The seed inside you, baby, do you feel it growing? You're having my baby.
I'm
a man in love, and I love what you're doing for me. Having my baby. I'm a man in love, and I love what's going through you.
Okay, we're back. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea. My guest is Dr. Mark Sloan, and his book is called Birthday, and it's a brand new publication from Random House. You have quite a bit to say in the book about pain and politics, mm-hmm. the age-old quest for painless childbirth, mm-hmm. which goes all the way back, of course, to Adam and Eve, mm-hmm. that very... a story that's been so unfortunate for women down the ages that we were meant to suffer. Mm. I liked the story about Queen Victoria and James Young Simpson. Mm. I think that was the first use of chloroform.
Yes.
Is it being? Would you talk a bit about
sure.
that?
Okay. Well, labor pain management has been tied up with politics since the Bible, as you pointed out. In fact, in the King James Version, where after God has finished cursing Adam, he turns his attention to Eve, and in the King James Version, it says she will deliver her children with pain. I'm not quoting it right, but it will be painful. But when you go back and look at the original Hebrew, it probably is some variation on the word toil or labor, not pain. So, but for centuries, that was, you know, at least the official line was that you did not try to, you know, do anything about labor pain because that was more or less blasphemous.
Yes.
Well, that all came to a head in the late 1840s, 1850s mm-hmm. with James Young Simpson, about 3 weeks after chloroform was introduced to Britain for the use in surgery. He decided that this would be perfect for what he called obstructed labors. So when you had a difficult labor and there was danger for both mother and baby, he started to use chloroform and was just galvanized with his experience that suddenly if you could, you know, basically put the mother to sleep temporarily, he could do what he needed to do to get the baby repositioned and get the baby out of there. And he very quickly went to applying it to normal labor, which set off a huge controversy. And in the book, I love the 19th century. There's some real characters in there.
Oh, there were wonderful characters.
But the fight came down to those who felt, you know, as you mentioned, the religious injunction. That was actually a relatively minor group of people. But a lot of prominent doctors were concerned that this was an untried, untested medication being used in an application unlike an amputation or something. This was, you were taking basically a healthy woman and healthy child and and giving them a medication or a drug that had not been tested, which was true. And then there was just a lot of people who hated James Simpson because he was a brilliant guy and he didn't mind reminding people of that fact. Well, two things sort of convinced people to move ahead with chloroform. One was that James Simpson was probably the first direct marketer of medical care. We, you know, we're so used to ads for everything, you know, allergy medicines, everything now on TV. Well, prior to that time, no one had ever discussed directly with the public medical treatments. And he put out pamphlets. He put out, you know, he gave speeches about chloroform to groups of women. And that started a public clamor for chloroform. Still, there was a fight back and forth about it. What finally sealed the deal is when Queen Victoria, who I didn't know anything or very little about prior to this, writing the book. She had 9 babies in 17 years. And she's a tiny little thing. I didn't realize she was about 4'10". By her 8th and 9th deliveries, I think she pretty much had it. And so as early as her 6th labor, she had thought about chloroform, but her own doctors had vetoed it as too dangerous. By her 8th and 9th, she basically told them, you know, get me the chloroform. And she described it as, I think, wonderfully, I mean, she really loved it. She thought it was great. And so that sort of got rid of, you know, all of the objections to chloroform, because it was pretty hard to, you know, start moral arguments against chloroform when the Queen said it was okay. But the problem was, it repeats itself with other pain relief options that followed that, was that Simpson was very meticulous with what he did. But this clamor forced doctors who really weren't ready, really weren't trained to use chloroform in labor to just sort of freelance. And so once Simpson died in 1869, it became obvious that a lot of women were being hurt. A lot of babies were dying because of too much chloroform. It wasn't necessarily that chloroform per se was bad, but it was just being used willy-nilly. And so chloroform kind of went out of fashion, not entirely, but it certainly, its popularity waned after that.
Mm-hmm. But then there were subsequent developments in painless childbirth, a German, as you describe it, obstetrical marvel called Twilight Sleep. Mm-hmm. And that was quite popular for a while.
It was a very brief window of time in the United States where that was popular. You know, once chloroform started to die down in popularity, women became more and more suspicious, especially as the feminist movement grew, about the intentions of obstetricians and doctors who delivered babies, that pain relief was moving forward great leaps and bounds in surgery, in general medicine, you know, broken bones, but it was not moving forward at all in obstetrics, and women were getting very suspicious about this. So in 1913, a couple of reporters from McClure's magazine were assigned to go to Freiburg, Germany, because there was rumors of this painless childbirth method, which the American translation of it is Twilight Sleep, was becoming popular. And basically with Twilight Sleep, there were two medications used, morphine and another one called scopolamine, which we tend to use more for motion sickness now. But the combinations the doctors used there, the woman would come into the clinic, she would go to sleep, and she would wake up with a baby. And this was to the feminist movement, this was a miracle, because labor pain was right up there with ending slavery and ending starvation and all kinds of things as one of the main afflictions of humankind. So it's similar to what happened with chloroform. The doctors in Freiburg were very meticulous, but the pressure by the consumer pressure to have Twilight Sleep here in the U.S. led to a lot of doctors who really didn't know what they were doing. You had to be pretty precise with Twilight Sleep, or you would have a woman who either remembered her experience or who got very disoriented and panicked from the scopolamine. And so here in the U.S., doctors just gave fixed doses of the medicine and then turned over the observation of the mother to a nurse who may or may not have any experience with Twilight Sleep, where in Germany, the doctor stayed with the woman the whole time. And so within about 15 months, the whole movement crashed. And what finally, because more and more women were you know, getting hurt or remembering the pain or disoriented. But the Mrs. Frances X. Carmody, who was the American face of Twilight Sleep, died in childbirth under the influence of Twilight Sleep. And then it just kind of went out of the public eye real quickly. So it was really only about 15 months. Mm-hmm. But then Twilight Sleep never really went away. I mean, any woman who had her baby in the 40s, 50s, 60s in the U.S., most of them were pretty heavily sedated and a lot of forceps use. Mm-hmm. But it really, Twilight Sleep was what was the big push to moving childbirth into hospitals.
Well, that was my experience. I had I have four children, and they were born during the 1950s, and I don't remember a thing about them. it was a piece of cake. You went in the hospital, they put you to sleep, and then pretty soon they woke you up, and you had this nice, sweet, cleaned up baby wrapped in a blanket, and you said, "Well, is it a boy or a girl?" And it's hard to imagine. Now, at one point, I asked the obstetrician, I guess it was after the third baby, and I had these children quite close together in a period of 6 years, and I asked about natural childbirth. And the obstetrician rode back in his chair and said, "What are you trying to prove?" Isn't that awful? And the same thing when I wanted to nurse those babies. I got no encouragement at all on nursing the babies. So things are changing.
That's exactly what my mom went through. She had seven of us from 48 to 61. Yes. And when I was starting to research this chapter, I thought, okay, I'll ask my mom what it was like. And her response was, she said, "You know, I'd like to help you, but you have to understand I wasn't really there."
Right.
And then I have my own birth record I requested from the hospital in Iowa where I was born.
And which you include in the book.
And there's also these three little – it's a standard form and for the infant feeding part, which didn't make it into the book. There's these three little handwritten check marks about breastfeeding attempts. And then after that, it's whoop formula. You know, so she tried three times and that was it. There was no support.
Yes. Well, fortunately, things are different now. With all the different methods of pain relief developed by different doctors in different parts of the world, who decides which method is going to be followed, and how do they reach? What's the process?
Well, again, I'm not usually part of that decision because I'm a pediatrician, not an obstetrician or an anesthesiologist. But generally, it's the woman's choice what she wants to do, but that choice is influenced by a lot of things, and more and more. I mean, one of the people I'll be speaking with up in Portland on Thursday. Is Judith Rooks. She's a very well-known midwife and researcher. And she's come to describe the United States as more or less an epidural monoculture.
Yes.
Most women, I think from the time of conception nowadays, think they assume they're going to have an epidural because their friends had epidurals, their mothers probably had epidurals. Mm-hmm. When you figure a third of births right now are C-sections, those are all with epidurals or with usually epidurals, not general anesthesia. And in some areas, 90-95% of births are with epidurals. So it's become so common. I don't think for a lot of women, a lot of thought goes into it. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean I think people assume that's the way. Mm-hmm. That's what you do.
Yes.
And you know, the very small number of women who are holding out for natural childbirth or trying to do it without medications. More and more, there's not a lot available outside of epidurals for them.
But you write that in other countries, particularly in Europe, a woman has many more choices.
Yeah, when I was researching the book, I initially just wanted to check out what were epidural rates in Europe, European countries, and I found that they were lower than our rates. They're starting to approach our rates, but they're not nearly as much as ours are right now. But I kept seeing references, especially to nitrous oxide, which most of us know of as laughing gas from the dentist's office. And I thought, well, gee, I wonder what the rates for nitrous use in the United States are. And I couldn't find any. I mean, I could find no reference to nitrous oxide use until I finally dug out a paper from 2002. And found that there are three hospitals on the West Coast that still use nitrous oxide, which at one point was very popular in the United States up until the 1950s. Mm-hmm. It's not; it's a moderately effective pain reliever. It's not it's not like an epidural where you're going to be numb.
Mm-hmm.
It's a moderately effective pain reliever, and probably more importantly, it gives people a sort of who cares attitude about pain. You just sort of dissociate from the pain, and it doesn't really seem to bother you very much. Mm-hmm. And that's why it works so well in a dentist's office.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a self-administered medication. A woman can decide when she wants to use it, how much she wants to use. It appears to be very safe for mother and baby. And it would give a good bridge between the woman who does not want an epidural but runs into a more painful situation than she was expecting. I think that's a situation where it would work well. Or a woman who was planning on an epidural and got there too late to be able to have an epidural. Mm-hmm. So there's roles for it. It wouldn't replace epidurals, and I don't think it should entirely.
Yeah.
But it would certainly be an added complement to what we have available now. And it's been used since the 1930s in Europe. So I think if there are any problems we'd know about that because we have this giant experiment with them using it and us not.
So. But if an obstetrician wanted to use it, would it be permitted? I mean, does an obstetrician have to get permission from the hospital?
Well, you'd have to have a hospital. Yeah, the hospital itself would
have to sign off.
Because you have to develop
it.
Protocols and how it's going to be used. Although it is used in emergency rooms, it's used in general anesthesia. And whenever you have surgery, you usually get nitrous oxide with it. So it's not that it's not in hospitals. It's just not, in a lot of hospitals, not approved for use for labor.
It's interesting. Incidentally, there is a fine chapter in this book on the cesarean. And it's well-researched, the history of it, and there's a vivid description of exactly what's involved in the procedure. But there were so many things that I wanted to talk with you about this morning that I decided to let our listeners read that chapter for themselves.
Okay.
Because I wanted to talk about the crowd in the labor room, the birthing for an audience. Mm-hmm. That's a fairly recent trend, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... Well, it depends on what you mean by recent. I mean, evolutionarily, we did not. I mean, no other primate species has birth attendants, people who come to help a mother at birth. We're the only ones. And it developed, it came about that way. Again, the changes we talked about with the pelvis. One of the things that happened was that our arms are relatively short compared to a gorilla's. So it's very hard for a laboring mother to reach down and help her baby if she needs to. It's also a fact of anatomy that other primate species, their babies come down. When they're born, they're face up, if you're imagining a woman on her back. And so if the baby has a cord around the neck or has some, you know, mucus in the mouth or something that needs to be clear, the mother can do that during the course of the labor. Well, a human baby usually comes out facing downward. And so you can't do that. So you have us short-armed humans and can't reach our babies. And it's such a prolonged labor compared to gorilla births and things. You know, a gorilla is a half an hour. We're like 18 hours on average. That birth attendants evolved mainly for protection, probably initially from predators and things, but eventually to help you get the baby out because it's very hard to do that by yourself. Now, in the modern times, we went from up until the early part of the 20th century, it was a family affair. It was usually, virtually all female, and usually you had your mother, your sisters, your aunts, you know, you had a group of female support people with you when you're having a baby and a midwife with you. Tied into that twilight sleep thing is that's sort of when childbirth moved to the hospital with the promise of painless childbirth. Mm-hmm. And then slowly the other people were seen to be as nuisances and they were slowly excluded from the hospitals. So it's not really starting in about the 1970s again, people slowly began to trickle back into the labor room, you know, support people who weren't medical people. And now sometimes it's almost comical how many people are in a delivery room.
Well, the incident that you describe in the book is certainly a comedy with the photographer elbowing you out of the way at one point.
With the big, you know, professional grade movie camera there. Yeah.
And do you view this as a favorable development to?
I do. Because there is lots of research to show that what a mother really needs in labor is continuous support. She needs somebody who's there to take care of her needs, not necessarily a medical person. They can come and go. But the very best person for that is usually an older woman who's gone through childbirth herself, who understands what's going on there and can talk the mother through this. And that can be a relative. It can be a trained person like a doula. But intermittent support, that's not a good thing. Now, it's kind of gone the other way because sometimes mothers don't know when to say enough with all the people in the room.
Right.
And if you've got some particularly overbearing relatives,
right.
You may not want them there. You have to be able to stick up for yourself.
At one point in the book, you discuss when the patient says to you, what would you do if this was your own child? Mm-hmm. And you give a beautiful answer to that question, which I'm going to let our readers discover for themselves. Mm-hmm. Another reason for them to go buy this book because that you really do that. But I want to spend a few minutes on the chapter about daddies. Mm-hmm. That was a delight to that you gave the dads a whole chapter. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was most interesting to me about that was I knew about women and hormones, but the whole business about men and hormones during the period of pregnancy, that was a complete surprise to me.
as it was to me. I did not know that at all when I was researching the book. I wanted to write about significant others, was the name of the section of the book. You know, people who come to births, and I think I have to, you know, I'm a daddy. I got to get some credit for the daddies out there. And excuse me. I came across some studies from the 1990s, actually, which were offshoots of studies of other primates, where they noticed that in primate species where a male is defending his harem, and so he's in close contact with the females, his testosterone level drops during the mate's pregnancy. His estrogen levels go up. You know, traditionally female hormones go up, including prolactin, which is the hormone that controls a lot of a mother's nesting type of behavior and also gets her breasts ready for nursing. So some researchers in Ontario thought, I wonder if that happens to humans. So they took a group of Canadian men at a prenatal class, and they sampled them for their hormones during the course of the pregnancy. And found that, yep, the same thing happens, that during the, and it's certainly not as dramatic a hormone change as what happens with women, but testosterone levels tend to be lower, estrogens and other female hormones tend to increase. And subsequent, pretty much around the world, they found the same thing. So it's not like a cultural, not a cultural thing. It's very much a human thing.
Does it depend on physical proximity?
No one's quite sure. It is definitely related to proximity. Now the question is, how does the woman waft these hormone changing voodoo things to her husband or her partner?
I was thinking particularly, you know, we hear quite a bit about the soldiers who are overseas waiting for the baby to be born at home,
right.
And in most cases they seem to be certainly emotionally tuned in, but. Do they miss out on this experience of going through these hormonal changes themselves because they're not present with their wives physically?
Well, no one has studied that yet. That's one thing that
I hope they do study that.
I think it would be worth studying that. Even the researchers themselves say, you know, it's far more complicated than just the hormone levels.
Yes.
You know, as to how well you bond with a child. Mm-hmm. But it certainly, the researchers described it as a feminization of a man's hormones, you know, during pregnancy.
Yeah.
And it does make a father more baby centric. You know, it turns a big lug into a guy who's starting to pay attention to babies. Sometimes doesn't always work, obviously.
Yeah.
That was one thing I wondered about is, soldiers gone off and other people who are suddenly, not near their mate, you know, so I would assume they wouldn't go through those changes, but probably I would imagine some of the experience, because the man's hormone profiles never really go back to the way they were either. So part of his reaction would likely have to do with what's his previous exposure, you know, was he from a big family where his mother's pregnant a lot? I don't think it's just... the fact that you're married to someone, I think if you're around, female, and that makes me wonder about my own hormones because I'm around pregnant women all the time. but it's a really interesting area, but this is kind of like the beginning of the research.
Yeah, I think it could be tremendously significant.
Yeah.
And speaking about the big families, in your chapter about the five senses, at birth and such a, beautiful description that you give of the baby's experience while still in the womb, the sensory experiences then, and how they hear the sounds and in some cases even can detect movements of light, and how important it is to, you know, to sing lullabies to the baby before it's born and that sort of thing. I was thinking that it's easier to do that with the first baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking my experience as a mother of toddlers while I was also also pregnant, and I was horrified to think, oh my goodness, that meant that the baby in the womb would be screaming at the little boys, get down out of that, you know, whatever the things were. And I thought, oh, have I marked my daughters by the fact that I was yelling at my son while the children were still in the womb?
Well, only time will tell, Rosemary. So.
Well, I'm afraid it already does. Yeah, but I think it's a good warning to mother. They can hear you in there.
Well, but I think it's similar to when you have I often get asked my pediatric practice with a baby who's a few months old, you know, what should I be doing? Should I be playing with my baby? But I have work to do and things. And really, your baby is fascinated with your voice, you know, and so when you're doing dishes and talking to the baby and explaining mm-hmm. this mundane task you're doing. That's helping the baby. That's stimulating the baby. That, and the same thing in utero. I'm sure all that screaming you did, Rosemary, was for the good of your children.
I meant well at the time. I always fall back on that excuse.
They learned what the real world was like.
I was doing my best with those little rascals. There is, I want to at least touch on your guided tour of the newborn baby. Mm-hmm. That is a beautiful chapter, which you describe as infant origami. Mm-hmm. Tell a little bit about that concept.
I had a resident when he was a couple of years ahead of me when I was an intern, or excuse me, I was in medical school still, and I was on a pediatric rotation, and he called me to a bedside and had me look at a baby, and he said, "Now, what's the diagnosis?" And I assumed something really was wrong with this kid, and so I kept trying to make up things, and finally I said, "It looks like a normal baby to me," and he said, "Bingo." And he said, "Now, if you don't know what's normal, you're never going to know what's abnormal with a baby." So I always remember this. He took the baby and basically just folded the baby back up into its in utero position. You put the hips, you know, the legs up on the hips and the arms to the side and the head to the side. And you could really see how the baby had fit in the womb. And it looked to me like he was doing origami. I remember that, you know, at the time. And it was a really valuable lesson in 5 minutes. And that is, if you babies are not little adults, and if you don't know what you're looking at with a baby, if you don't know what's supposed to be there or why they are shaped differently than us, you can make some big mistakes in how you're taking care of them. Plus, you can scare their parents half to death.
On its way to being born, the fetus flexes, extends, and rotates its body, executing a complex series of maneuvers not seen in any other primate. Why are we so different? Here's the problem in a nutshell. Newborn babies, then and now, have heads that are just too big to fit down the birth canal in the round fetal state. Take a look at a newborn's head. His ears reach out nearly to his shoulders. If that head-to-shoulder ratio never changed, an average adult would have about a size 20 head, and there isn't enough polyester in all of China to make a world full of baseball caps that big. Getting that big fancy toolmaker's noggin out of the womb with minimal damage to mother and fetus became one of the great engineering challenges of human evolution. It was more or less the same challenge faced by a man who gets carried away building a boat in his garage. Imagine that a man starts out with a simple boat in mind, maybe a kayak or a canoe, something he can paddle around the park lagoon on a Sunday morning. As the project unfolds, though, his imagination catches fire. Why just a simple tub, he thinks? Why not a sailboat, or a ketch, or a schooner? So he adds bulwarks and gunwales and a crow's nest. Soon, he's upgraded his little canoe to an ocean-going yacht capable of winning the America's Cup. One problem, though. His boat is now way too big to fit out the garage door. The man is left with two options. Make the boat smaller, or the opening bigger. In the end, he does a little of both. He lowers the crow's nest and widens the doorway. And one morning, to much fanfare, the SS show-off squeezes ever so carefully out the door and into the big lagoon of life. That, minus the crow's nest, is the story of the coevolution of the human head and the female pelvis.
You have a website.
I do.
Which people can find out more about you, and also where they can find out about the national book tour that you're about to start out on. Mm-hmm. I've already emailed people in a couple of places where you're going to be and say, don't miss this.
Oh, thank
be
you.
Sure to go see Mark Sloan. You know, we want to do everything we can to get the word out about this unusual book. Mm. I was wondering, where will the bookstores place this? I mean, it's not self-help. It's not. What is it?
Well, it's a difficult one. The book passes down in Corte Madera had me next to Dr. Spock just alphabetically as an advice book. I was like, so there's a book called How We Die by Sherwin Nuland, which is a beautiful book about obviously the other end of life.
Yes.
And that one has had the same problems. It kind of gets booked in the science. It gets shelved in the history. So I'm not quite sure. I think it should be shelved in all those places.
I do too. And, genre is a strange concept anyway.
Because it's not a how-to or advice book. So when it shows up in those areas, I think people misunderstand what it's about.
That's right.
If you have suggestions on where I should shelf it, I'm open.
It's not a book about how to deliver your own baby.
No.
Incidentally, that you hear sometimes in fiction that's inserted. And when I was interested in reading your take on it, because I always wondered if it was actually physically possible to birth your own baby alone, and I guess it is possible, but highly unlikely.
No, you many, many cases of women giving birth by themselves where it's like breech births.
Yeah.
Impossible.
That'd be impossible.
But normal vaginal births, there's scads of stories of women who are doing it. They weren't really happy about doing it that way.
No.
Because our nature is to call for help when something like that's going on. And when there's no help coming, especially if it's your first baby and you don't know what's happening, it's gonna be a terrifying experience.
That's right. But, so this is not a book about how to birth your own baby, folks.
No.
It's just a wonderfully written description of the history and the practices surrounding birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mark, thank you so much for making time for us. I know you're a very busy man, and we appreciate your coming in. And we urge all our listeners to get your hands on a copy of Birthday by Mark Sloan.
Well, thanks for inviting me on the program. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, good. And thanks to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show, and Robin Pressman, our program director. And we encourage you to tune in every Wednesday evening at 7 for the KRCB Literary Hour. You can hear Gil Mansurg on Word by Word, Catherine Hastings on Word Temple, and A Novel Idea will be back on June 10th. And we'll look forward to your being present then. In the meantime, remember, there's no such thing as too many books.
Sally.
Irwin, darling, I didn't mean to call you home from the office, but there's something very important I must tell you.
What is it?
It's so hard to explain, darling, but Irwin, up until now, there's just been the two of us, and, well, now the two of us are going to be three.
You're taking in a boarder?
No, Irwin, you don't understand. We're expecting a visitor. We're going to have someone who looks just like you.
Oh, you're going to buy a Cocker Spaniel?
No, sweetheart. Pretty soon, you'll notice around the house, well, something new has been added. What I mean is, well, a little bundle of...
Oh, darling, a little bundle.
Yes, Irwin, that's it. Now you know.
At last, my laundry is back.
No, darling, we're having a baby.
A baby? Now I know. We've been married a year or more. It was a year worth living. Now we've got a thrill in store. Here's the news we're giving. We're having a baby, my baby and me. You'll read it in Winchell that we're adding a limb to our family tree. While pushing that carriage, how proud I will be. There's nothing like marriage. Ask your father and mother and they'll agree. I stayed home every night. Love was a game and I played it. Hello, Mom. What a fight. Gee, it was tough, but I made it. I'm thankful for Wheaties. They made a champion of me. We're having a baby. My baby and me.
You've made me so happy.
No trouble at all.
I'm proud of you, Pappy.
I'm so glad you invited the stork to call.
There wasn't much to it.
You're just being shy.
No, honey, there wasn't much to it. Say, if Jessel can do it, so can I.
Thanks to you, life is bright. Why, you brought me joy beyond measure.
Oh, don't thank me.
No?
Quite all right. Honestly, it was a pleasure.
Just think, it's my first one.
The next one's on me.
We're having a baby, my baby and me.